My name is David Mazenbring, and this is the second in a five-session series called Investing in a Better World. And I do mean investing. Investing money. This session is called The Problems and Promise of Microcredit. And it's intended to just really provide a basic, well, more than a basic, education about microfinance, microcredit. Sharing with you what the hype is all about, why do some believe it's finally an effective answer to addressing the problems of global poverty. Some think the most effective strategy there is for addressing global poverty. But why has it gone from that considerable hype to, in the last 12 to 15 months, getting a lot of bad press in all over the place for and being accused of being overblown, of leading to suicides, populist revolt? By the time you walk out of the door here in an hour, I hope you'll really be able to sort that hype out. But I want to start by thanking you for being here, because because it's really important. A lot of people are desperate. The change in food prices that is an inconvenience to us is literally a life and death issue for huge numbers of people with whom we share this planet, our island home. Mahatma Gandhi has written, "Poverty is the worst form of violence." That specialist in nonviolence. 6.8 billion people on the planet, and two-thirds of them live with under $2 a day. 2.66 billion of the world's 6.8 billion live on less than $2 a day. A billion people, a billion of those 2.66 are young and elderly. 2 million people a year die from lack of access to safe water. It's a totally preventable situation. And it's only that those of us who have the means and the know-how and the ability to do something about the lack of access to water, and it's not just drinking water, it's also sanitation, are not motivated to do anything about it, which is why I'm thanking you for being here, for caring enough about what you don't have to care about to actually consider or inform yourself about strategies for addressing it. Esther Duflo at MIT's Poverty Lab was profiled in the May 17th issue of The New Yorker last year. May 17th of 2010 is a fascinating article about this young French woman who runs the Poverty Lab. And she says that 25,000 children a day are dying from preventable diseases. She'd be including the water-related ones in there. 25,000 children a day, which is why I'm really grateful that you're taking an hour out to inform yourself about the practical ins and outs of a strategy that can make a difference. She sets up a chart of aid from the global north and gross domestic product from Africa, stretches it back decades. The curve on aid goes way up, the numbers on gross domestic product stay the same. And then she's the one who says, we don't necessarily know that there's a cause and effect relationship there until we measure it. And then here's a quote from her. "We're not any better than the medieval doctors and their leeches at knowing how to address this issue." I think that the Gates Fund, are there more chairs, or are we out of chairs? One more here. One, two, three, there are chairs, just make your way in. The Gates Foundation, which prides itself on doing solid research, I mean, they're not addressing every problem that they know how to address, they're really focusing on problems that take research to get better addressed. And they've been doing a lot of research in their section called Financial Services for the Poor. So these next statistics come from them. 80 to 90% of those people who live under $2 a day, live on less than $2 a day, 80 to 90% of them have no access to banks. 70% of the population in developing countries has no access to formal financial services. Think about that the next time you go to your cash machine or write a check. More than half of the adults in the world don't use formal financial services. One of the reasons that we get tripped up in looking at microcredit is on interest rates, right? It's one of the most controversial things about microcredit. When people hear that interest rates are in the neighborhood of 20%, they think that's highway robbery. It's outrageous. And I argue that we are so out of touch with how most people live that we can't even relate to what is a good deal for them. How many are Washington State residents? Maybe half the room. After a multi-year battle between lobbyists for the payday loan shops and the faith community, it was only last year that Washington State capped the maximum annualized interest rate that payday loan shops can charge, which is why they're now closing after a tremendous growth spurt. So take a guess. What do you think Washington State finally agreed to cap the maximum interest rate for payday, that payday loan shops can charge?
50%.
39%. Your guesses are pretty good. 39% was so controversial that the bill failed for 2 or 3 years before it finally got passed last year. 39%. The poor lack access to credit that we, you and I, take for granted. Well, less and less, but I mean, if you try to get a loan lately, you know it's not like it was a couple of years ago. But basically, we have access not only to credit, but to financial services in general. Savings is huge. The Gates Foundation is not dealing much with microcredit at all, because their argument is it's been discovered, people are working on it, it's being implemented. Their focus on savings, how to help the world's poor be able to save for that medical emergency that or the drought or some crisis. Most of the world, half of the world's adults don't use formal financial services. So thank you for being here and focusing on what might seem like a rather obscure and unnecessary subject. It is unnecessary in the communities in which we live, but it's literally a life and death issue for millions of the people with whom we share this world. Now, Professor Muhammad Yunus, who I'll talk about in a minute, has written, "Poverty is the absence of all human rights." Poverty is the absence of all human rights. We pride ourselves in this country on being very focused on human rights. It's one of we've had presidents that stake their reputation on exporting it, right? Poverty is the absence of all human rights. Muhammad Yunus was a Fulbright scholar, Vanderbilt University financial something student, who in 1974, during a desperate famine in Bangladesh, his native Bangladesh, felt so bad about what was happening to so many people that he found himself in a situation where he loaned the equivalent of $27 to a group of 42 families. Now, group is a key word there. He was in the banking world, the financial services world, at a high academic level, but just out of human compassion, he did what no banker would do. Without any collateral, he gave a $27 loan to this group of 42 families. And that led him to his results. What he experienced was so astonishing that he started a research project and got some funding, and in 2 years later formed the Grameen Bank. How many have heard of it? All right, just what do you know about it? They give microcredit. Very good.
microcredit institution.
Yeah, it was really the first. He invented microcredit. He says he stumbled upon it. And he's got, I think it's Banker to the Poor. Isn't that one of his books? I haven't read it. He says that everything commercial bankers did, he tried to do the opposite, and it worked. Bankers want collateral, so he didn't take collateral. Bankers want easy to reach people, he went to the harder to reach people. On and on and on. The Grameen Bank in the indigenous language of Bangladesh actually literally means Bank of the Villages. And it is to the tune of like 94% today owned by its borrowers. When was the last time you got a stake of the bank you took a mortgage out with, right? It was born as a research project, and basically it revolves around two things: uncollateralized loans that are made within accountability circles. We're going to go through this spectrum in a little while, but there's the accountability circle. There's the group of 42 families that he lent $27 to. And his insight was that when you lend to a group that is accountable to one another within the group, a group of peers, they will hold the borrowers, the individual members, accountable in a way that no rural Bangladeshi woman, even if a banker did invest in her, would she feel obligated to repay. By 2008, the bank had, by 2006, the Grameen Bank had 2,100 branches scattered throughout Bangladesh. And typically banks only, in the global south, banks only operate in the cities. You get out to the rural areas and you just don't have a chance of finding any bank. They had 2,100 branches by 2006, had loaned to the poor $7.6 billion. By 2008, 95% of those loans went to women. Women are a far more reliable borrower of microcredit than men. Why? They spend the money on their children and the welfare of their household. What do you think men spend their money on if they get a loan and they use it? Liquor, yeah. They go the parties, status symbols. They don't spend it on their children. So if you want to reach the poorest of the poor in an effective way, it's women. No collateral. From the Wikipedia information about Grameen Bank, I like this phrase. It's based on the idea that the poor have skills that are underutilized. A group-based credit approach is applied, which utilizes the peer pressure within the group to ensure the borrowers follow through and use caution in conducting their financial affairs with strict discipline, because the credit rating of the whole group is at stake. So if the group gets a $500 loan and consists of 10 members, maybe not all 10 have the native entrepreneurial instincts, but if enough of them do that, they can meeting weekly, get help from one another, because the whole group has an interest in repaying the loan on time so that they can get another even larger loan in the next cycle. They help one another and they hold one another accountable. You might not care what a banker in a town an hour away thinks of you, but you do care what your neighbor says about you in a small village. Ensuring repayment eventually and allowing the borrowers to develop good credit standing. Grameen believes that charity is not an answer to poverty. It only helps poverty to continue, as it creates dependency and takes away the individual's initiative to break through the cycle of poverty. Whereas loans offer people the opportunity to take initiatives in business or agriculture, providing earnings and enabling them to pay off debt. Grameen regards all human beings, including the poorest, as endowed with endless potential, and that unleashing the creativity in each individual should be the answer to poverty. Grameen has offered credits to many poor women, illiterate, and unemployed people. It created access to credit on reasonable terms, such as the group lending system and weekly installment payment with reasonably long-term loans, enabling the poor to build on their existing skill to earn a better income in each cycle of loans. By 1995, the Grameen Bank was funding 90% of its loans with interest income and deposits collected. So they form in 76, they start making these loans, they raise some capital with which to make the loans, but when they make the loans, they charge interest to the accountability circle, and sometimes those circle are paying interest back, sometimes the ultimate borrower is paying interest back to the circle. With that interest, and also the encouragement of the Grameen Bank to its borrowers to save, so they both made loans here, but they also encouraged the borrowers to save and made savings possible. Savings is a huge problem for most people in the world. Just getting the money to a safe place, not having it under your mattress where your husband will find it and go drink it up. Savings is a huge issue. So they encouraged savings and they charged interest, and by 1995, 90% of their lending was coming from the loans with interest income and deposits collected. Now, that read sustainable and scalable. When we deal with issues of global poverty, we have to bring a hard business sense to it. And the two most important questions that I'm going to hammer over and over today are, is it scalable? Because you can come up with a great concept, but can you scale it out to the need? I love Habitat, but is it scalable to the need of the world's housing? I'm not saying that it's not a good system if it's not. But we have to think about, is it scalable? So often, we're just so excited about something that makes us feel good to be part of, that we don't actually ask ourselves, can this grow to meet the needs? Is it?
Yeah, that's the question. It depends how you define Habitat.
Okay.
Because right now, Habitat in Guatemala, the tradition is build a $4,000 house that half the people can't afford. The movement now is looking at safe houses, to upgrade houses where people are extremely poor. So they have safe banos, safe stoves, Chagas disease, things like that. So it depends on how you define that function.
Okay, yeah, there are different ways, different strategies for improving the housing that people need. That's your statement, right. And I think there are a lot of things worth doing that may not meet the overall need, but they're worth doing to every person who gets the help of that. In using the word scalable and sustainable, I'm inviting us to consider whether the system we're talking about can sustain itself and grow to meet the level of need. And two of the things that I really like about microcredit is that it is sustainable when it's practiced correctly, and it's scalable with more investment, which is another reason why it's really good here. All right, let's look at this cycle. How does it actually work? Now, this is in general. There are a lot of practices of it. And I'm going to use a cycle that is generally true, but it won't apply in every situation. For example, the sister parish may skip this. Well, we can adapt it, but let's start here. I'm an investor. My wife and I have $25,000 invested in a microfinance fund. Okay? I can't get the money out to the borrowers. I didn't start with $25,000, but I've been invested for 24 years, and I'm so excited about it that I keep adding to it. So I'm an investor, and I give my money to a fund. The fund turns around, takes my money, and lends it out to various MFIs, microfinance institutions. Okay, what's that? Aldea Global is a farmers association, 1,400 member farmers in the northern mountains of Nicaragua. These are small to medium-sized farmers, no large farmers. They pay $50 a year to be a member of Aldea Global, and I think something like 35 of that $50 goes into a savings account for them, and 15 pays for the costs of the board of directors of the organization. So nothing goes to the operating expense of Aldea Global. It's a farmers association. And one of its, in 1990, when a guy named Warren Armstrong became the director of Aldea Global, Aldea was 100% dependent on grants to fund itself. It had been started by Mercy Corps about 1990, it started by Mercy Corps. By 2000 or 2001, it's still 100% dependent on international grants, maybe USAID, maybe Mercy Corps, maybe some European organizations. Wherever they can find a grant, they can live for another year or two, and they can hire their staff. Warren Armstrong comes in about 2001, and he said, this is not sustainable, and we are jumping every year to meet the whims of funders. This year, they're excited about water projects, so we got to organize ourselves and do water projects and get a grant for that. And next year they want us to do children's health care, and then we got to shift or fire some people and hire new people. We need to come up with some sustainable activities that today, Aldea Global, thanks to two business lines. One is coffee marketing. They're in the northern mountains of Nicaragua. They grow great coffee. So the association said, we will help them market their coffee and get a better price, skip the middlemen, help our farmers sell their coffee at a better price, which involved helping them process the coffee and get it to market. And the second thing Aldea Global did, said, we're going to get into the microcredit business. After 10 years of functioning, they did a strategic study of their organization, what was working, what needed to do better, and they said, our people, especially the women, need access to credit. They need alternate forms of credit availability. So Aldea got into the micro-lending business. So they become a microfinance institution. Most funds, microfinance funds, are going to choose a fairly narrow niche of what kind of MFIs they will lend money to, because it's a risk. Anytime you lend money, you're taking a risk. And if you work with, you know, urban-based business incubators that have a long track record, you have a lower risk than if you work with some new farmers association up in the mountains that has never done this before, right? That's a higher risk business. So different funds have different risk strategies and different kinds of foci, different priorities. Aldea Global takes the money that they can raise from various funds. I think they've got about $500,000 now that they're working with, and it comes from about three different sources. A funny story is they had, it's actually more than funny, they had some, I think it was a U.S. church group that wanted to give them money for their microloan fund, but only on condition that they wouldn't charge interest to the borrowers. And Warren refused to accept it. I said, why? He said, because we would be setting our borrowers up for ultimate business failure. If we give them access to credit at unrealistic market prices, as soon as our credit is over, they've built a business model based on free credit, and when it runs out and they no longer qualify for ours, and they have to get credit from the market, they can't survive anymore. Right? The whole idea is to take people that have never had access to credit, get them started, and instead of making the loans this way, you want eventually for them to be able to make the loans directly over here. But this might be a $1,000 or $2,000 loan. And this might be a $500 loan to a group of 10 people. So the way Aldea Global works is they make some of that $500,000 is being loaned to small farmers, members of the association, who are operating on a scale that they can actually handle a $1,000 or $2,000 loan. Maybe it's as an individual. I met a group of three siblings that were farming together and had taken one loan as three members of a family. I think it was two brothers and a sister. But I also, and am most interested, the poorest of the poor are right here. So Aldea has this staff person, Doña Eva, a saint in my book, who goes out to the villages and finds women who no way could ever afford the $50 membership fee to Aldea Global. And she starts by doing seminars for the men. I should not take the time to go through how she convinces the men to let their women folk actually participate in this in one of these accountability circles. I've met several of them. And those would be 10 women that have never had any credit, never had any opportunity to start any kind of a business at all. And Aldea Global will train the women in how to keep books and then loan them $500 for 6 months. Loan the group, the accountability circle of peers. Loan the group of women $500. Maybe eight of the women, maybe five of the women thrive, three make it, two come in subpar. They can't quite, you know, the idea of one, I mean, some of the ones that I met is they get into the food business. One woman used her $50 to start to take the truck to the nearby larger town, buy a live pig, bring it back, slaughter it, and then cook up some of the meat and sell it. So she became a reseller of pork in her neighborhood, both in prepared form and in raw meat kind of form. And she did it in a smart way and was building up her business that way. She was successful. Somebody who buys used clothing in the big city nearby and brings it back and tries to resell it might or might not be successful. The accountability circle, if there are two who don't make it, they aren't going to be part of the next loan. You know, the eight will just say to those two, you may not be cut out for this, you know, and bring in two more. Because the circle as a whole has its credit at stake. The accountability circle makes the loans here to the, you know, I mean, maybe the ultimate borrower is big enough for that, but in another way, the ultimate borrower can be here, these 10 women.
Does the accountability circle pay back the loan for the people that, okay.
Right. Some representative of the accountability circle signs a promissory note, gets the $500, and then at the end of the 6 months, they owe it back to Aldea Global. Mm-hmm. And if they pay on time with interest, there's always interest. There's interest, the fund, you know, so interest goes, money goes out more expensively than it is received. The fund charges some interest to the MFI. The MFI charges some interest to the ultimate borrower. And then interest comes back here, and it comes back here, and it comes back to me. Any questions about the cycle? Because my money is lent with interest at every stage, and interest is paid at every stage, my $25,000, when on a really bad day, I sit down and just try and calculate how long have I invested, how much money, divided by an average of $200 every 6 months, how many families are working their way out of poverty with my help today. And I always end up feeling better about that, about myself, after I work through that math, right? Because none of my money is going to overhead. The overhead is covered by the interest that comes back to the fund. Get that? That's a really crucial point. That's what makes it sustainable. My investment, unless it's lost, which it hasn't been, and I've been in one fund for 24 years, my investment is always at work accomplishing the purposes that I want it to without being consumed by the overhead needs of the employees of the fund or the employees of the MFI. So much so that Alder Global gets 40% of its, no, earns 60% of its operating budget today from coffee sales and from microfinance. And they're only 40% dependent now. In just 10 years, they've shifted from being 100% dependent and hearing Mercy Corps say, you know, one more year and that's it. We never bargained to just keep funding you forever. Any questions so far?
So Mercy Fund is that second link there.
No, Mercy Corps was an originator of Aldea Global. Aldea Global is an example of a microfinance institution. These funds, Kiva is a fund, although Kiva is technically flying under the radar. Kiva is not an investment fund. When you give money to Kiva, you're making an unsecured loan, basically. And it's not a registered investment product. The fund that I invest in is a registered investment product, and most of them are. Kiva is a little bit of a strange animal on its own.
Might the accountability circle consist of people who are in the same business together, and does that work any better than if they're all individually?
I have not met with many, but of the ones that I've met with that are started by Aldea Global, there are two types of circles. There's businesses, they group the business together. So if someone's reselling clothing or reselling food or, you know, starting a business, they'll make sure that they're not all the same business, but they're all doing a business. Or another accountability circle will be agriculture. Because one of the things that Doña Eva does with the men is convince them to give their wife a little plot of land and to let her cultivate. Agricultural cultivation in Nicaragua has traditionally been man's work. And so she has to go out and convince them. It's a long story how she gets them there. But she works to get them to that point. So that one circle might be all agriculturally oriented borrowers, and another circle might be made of businesses, but they will be each a different type of business. Does that answer your question?
I wondered if there are examples of people in the same business and if that works any better than...
It's a big world. There must be all kinds of examples. But if they're all in the same village, you know, they don't really need 10 bakers or 10 people who go to the market and buy vegetables and bring them back to the neighborhood and resell those vegetables. They're better off with 10 different businesses, so they're not competing against each other and they can help each other. But they're all doing some form of business as opposed to planting, you know, buying seed, planting it, and then selling the crops and repaying the loan with what they've sold.
So that's what the accountability circles are things. Well, we already have one dried fish seller, we're going to give a loan to it.
Some would work that way, right. But, you know, there are now tens of thousands of accountability circles. So for me to stand here and characterize them as one type would be misleading.
What are typical interest rates at each of those steps?
We're going to get to that because it's all over the map and it's part of the story for why the thing has started to generate some bad publicity. Can you hold the question? Hold me accountable for addressing it as we move along here a little bit. So I want to ask the question, is microcredit the answer?
No.
You know, why not?
Because it's not completely scalable.
depends on how much investment you can raise.
Right, but I don't, my opinion is you couldn't raise enough to get everybody involved who would theoretically want to be involved. I'm not bad mouthing it, I think it's a great
thing. Yeah, right. No, you're a realist in your assessment of how many people in the global north are willing to help.
Right. And how many in the global south need the help.
And how big the bubble can be and still function.
Right. I think the two reasons it's not the answer, and then I'll give you some reasons why I think it is. I mean, my response to the question, my own question, is that the answer would be yes and no. Four yeses and two noes. The two no's are poverty is too complex for one strategy. Okay? Water is a huge issue. So if you get credit and you start a business, but you still don't have access to good sanitation or safe water, your children are still going to die from preventable diseases, diarrhea. Gender discrimination is a big factor in poverty. Access to health care is another one. And there will be others. So poverty, I mean, the best practitioners of microcredit will tell you it's one critical element, but it isn't the only one. And a second reason that it's not the answer is that, well, before I do that, I want to cite the reason, the yeses. It unleashes the creativity in service to the poor. Poor people are desperate. When you are desperate, you can be very creative at coming up with a solution because you really need it. And microcredit unleashes, empowers the creativity that poor people have. It unleashes it. Secondly, it's dignifying. It's a hand up, not a hand out. And people really get charged up about what they are doing for themselves when they get a little bit of credit. It's dignifying, as opposed to charity, which is very, demeaning, yeah. Thirdly, it's sustainable because of the interest rates. And fourthly, I think it is scalable to the degree that we can spread the word about it. To the degree we can't, it's not. Now, it's not the answer because poverty is too complex and because there's many different kinds of it. Okay? Ever heard of your local neighborhood loan shark who will break your knees if you don't repay him at 100% tomorrow what he lends you today? You know, calculate the interest rate on that one.
Or take your house back.
That's not a micro loan in most cases. For the poor, you know, who have got a critical needs today, the loan sharks are always out there. And they are microcredit providers too. So the spectrum of microcredit providers is, we have to acknowledge, very big. And there are some on one end whose purpose is to help the poor work their way out of poverty, and they're keeping the interest rates down as low as they can and still make it realistic. Remember my story from Warren. He doesn't want to give the money for, doesn't want to give the credit for free because you're helping develop a business on free credit. That's not true to market conditions. But it's a long way over here to the loan shark who feeds on your vulnerability and charges you literally interest rates in the thousands of a percent.
Would the World Bank fit in there?
Not as a microloan provider.
But as a loan.
Predatory, yes.
Predatory, yes, but not on the micro scale. So we're getting ready to come to the question about, I think, what are the interest rates? 1997, you had 13 million microloan recipients worldwide. By 2007, 10 years later, you had 100 million. That's a lot of growth. In 2004, you had 30 of these funds lending to MFIs who lent to the ultimate borrowers. By 2009, just 5 years later, you had 100 funds. That's explosive growth. In 2005, the UN proclaims the International Year of Microcredit. In 2006, the Nobel Peace Prize is granted to the Grameen Bank and Muhammad Yunus. The Nobel Peace Prize. Not the prize for economics. I drive a red Vespa scooter, and on the back is a bumper sticker that says, I've got to remember what it says. I haven't been on it in a couple weeks. Counter terror with justice. I maintain that if the United States, instead of cutting and running, you know, we funded our enemies in Afghanistan when they were the enemies of the Russians, right? And the minute the Russians left, we pulled out of Afghanistan, right? And we only went back in with full military force. If we put 1% of what we've spent militarily in Afghanistan into microcredit, there would be no popular base of support for Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan today. That's why microcredit won the Nobel Peace Prize, not the prize for economics. Well, with this explosive growth, guess what? A lot of people, not necessarily the loan shark who would break your knees, but everybody from Citibank to private IPOs, a lot of people rushed into microcredit because they realized there was money to be made. It was so hot and it was spreading so fast, and so many of these funds became driven not by social purpose investing, but by financial, you know. And the range of what investors get paid by funds is all over the map. There's a prominent one in Seattle that only takes qualified investors, read rich people, you know, people who can make investments in six figures. And it will offer you in the neighborhood of 5 to 8% return. I get 2% from the fund that I invest in. Well, there's a trade-off. The more money you want to repay, the more money you want to make coming back to the investors, the less money... it changes the whole dynamic. I went to a seminar, St. Mark's, where I work in Seattle, hosted a seminar back in February with all kinds of microcredit providers. We didn't host it. It was just somebody else put it together and used our church to hold it at. And I went. And they said, is microcredit good or bad? I mean, that was kind of the question amid all this controversy. And the answer became, it depends on why money comes into a given fund. If there's an IPO, as there was in India by SKS, this new fund, and they got spectacularly successful because the fastest growing micro-lending was taking place in India, and SKS raised some phenomenal amount of money because everybody wanted to get in on that action and get some of that money out of it. Well, guess what? The people who get all that capital have to start pushing it out. And so they push it to MFIs, and the MFIs push it out. It's not unlike what happened in the mortgage crisis in this country. Sure. There's a lot of money to be made. We're not going to be around to collect it because we're going to have resold the loan before we ever have to really hold you accountable for it. So just push it out there. Give people more credit than they need. And what has happened in a couple of places, I'm going to reference Nicaragua and India, is that people, so much micro loan money was available, and nobody was keeping track of how many loans you had. So you could walk into one office one day, get a micro loan, and when it was time to repay that, you walked into another office over here, bought another loan, repaid it, and then pretty soon you did a third loan, and pretty soon, you know, the whole house comes crashing down, and people started committing suicide in India, in a place called Andhra Pradesh. And the government got scandalized and banned microcredit. Or in Nicaragua, you have this no pago movement. I don't pay. And there was a kind of a populist fire that broke out and got some feeding by the president until the World Bank came in and had a meeting with him and said, if you're going to really jump on board of the no pay movement, then we're going to pull out all of all the capital we have in your country. And then he shut up and he kind of stalled. So populist uprisings or even suicides in some cases came from over-indebtedness by people who, and a lack of transparency about the interest rates. Because the more money you're pushing out there, the less you really want to tell people how much it's going to cost them. The ethical providers, which, you know, in 04 were 30, my investment goes back to 87. At that point, I don't actually know how many funds there were, but I guarantee you it was under a dozen. There were very few people doing this at that point. And they were, so a few ethical and social performance motivated types, and then all of a sudden you get all kinds that are charging interest rates that they're not keeping track of, or that the charger is keeping track, but the borrower isn't. And they're getting multiple loans because there's no credit bureaus. And the whole thing has started to drift because it's drifting back toward the loan shark and away from the best providers. So is it bust? No. Do you have to be more careful about which kind of an organization you get involved in? Yes. How do you do that? The industry has grown quickly, says the fund that I am invested in. Microfinance has proven to be sustainable and has therefore become financially interesting for many organizations and individuals. There's a danger of too much focus on the financial rather than the social return. And that's the key. If you look at a fund, you wanna know, where does the financial versus the social work? That's one question to ask. And the second one, especially for those of you who like Kiva, is whether the organization is donor-centric or borrower-centric. How would you tell? Just take a guess while I check my notes.
The flyer, I mean, the marketing might have more, and the borrower-centric might have more, like, pictures of children in the that might be being helped versus the interest rate would be all over the, like, your return rate you could get might be all over the marketing, the donor-centric.
Basically, you know, there's no free lunch, so there's a trade-off. The higher the interest rate the fund is offering, the less... You know, the more somebody's paying, or the less that is being put into measuring social performance. Measuring social performance is a concept you just gotta learn and hang on to. Because how did microcredit get so hot and raise so much money? Mrs. Gonzalez was very poor. She got a $100 loan 2 years ago. Look at her today. And there are funds all over the place that have raised tons of money with a few stories like that. Now, who's actually going to invest money in measuring Mrs. Gonzalez's progress? Or not just, I mean, you can find a Mrs. Gonzalez that you can point to, but if you've made 1,000 loans, what does it cost you to actually survey 1,000 recipients and find out what they're doing? The best funds today are actually putting money into, one example is called Progress Out of Poverty Index, PPI.org. Progress Out of Poverty Index is a little 10-question questionnaire that the MFI employee who goes out and collects the money from the accountability circles can quickly assess. As you walk up the door to the home, is it what's the roofing material being used? What's the house made out of? Is it a dirt floor or cement floor? Are the kids in school or not? It's a 10 question that's country specific, because roofing materials in one country are not the same as in another country. So there's actually the Grameen Foundation, which is a U.S. nonprofit that supports the Grameen Bank. They're separate entities. Grameen Foundation has developed this Progress Out of Poverty Index and then works with my fund and a couple of others to actually train MFIs to start collecting data to put money into measuring the results. Measuring social performance costs money if you want to do it with any kind of integrity. And some funds are willing to put money into measuring social performance, and some aren't. But that's one way you tell whether the fund is borrower-centric or donor-centric.
Is there also a difference between the programs that are run by borrowers and those that are run by investors? I mean, is that a way to tell the difference?
Yeah, although, I said the Grameen Bank is owned by its borrowers. I'm not sure it'd be fair to say it's run by these rural illiterate women in Bangladesh. Not run by them, but it's owned by them. I don't know what their governance structure is. I will say that, the fund that I'm interested in that I will be introducing on Friday, it has a global board of directors that is weighted in favor of representatives from the borrowing countries rather than the investing countries. So that's a key indicator of borrower-centric. One question, and then I want to use Kiva as an example of how to spot donor-centric.
I was just wondering if your payment and interest rate wouldn't be a solid statistic.
Interest rate is a solid
based
statistic.
Based on what you're talking about, if they sustain repayment and if they can sustain an interest rate, things must be going pretty well.
Well, but you may do it for a while, and then, you get the pushback because of the over-indebtedness. You can push out more loans than you can pull back.
Sure.
And a lot depends on how much interest you're charging. Now, you asked for typical rates. I don't know the industry well enough to give you averages. I think that the best funds will limit how much the MFI is going to charge the ultimate borrower. Many funds will not. Kiva, unless they've changed it recently, one of the reasons Kiva's a rare exception is that when you give your money to Kiva, you get no interest back. You get your money promised back without interest. And then Kiva gives your money to the MFI without interest, which sounds like a good deal until. What Kiva wants, instead of interest from the MFI, they want narrative. They want pictures. And they want stories about the borrowers, right? Why? Because they're oriented toward the needs of the donor. The donor, what has made Kiva spectacularly successful at raising more money than it knew how to push out. And when you got more money than you know how to push out, you've got a temptation to push it out faster than they can really use it, or to only push it to the MFIs that are already set up and strong and can take lots of it, as opposed to the younger, riskier ones that you want to bring along. Kiva I know of one senior industry official who is livid about the way in which Kiva has pushed MFIs that have been trying to develop good business practices and forced them to become good public relations specialists by providing digital photography and good narrative story. Because that's what Kiva wants from the MFI, because that's what investors need in order to give more money to Kiva. So I argue that Kiva is a donor-centric model of it. But, that's just my opinion. Kiva would argue with me.
Who's benefiting from Kiva back in this end if the investor doesn't benefit?
Well, the investor gets the good feeling of charity that I'll be talking about tomorrow.
There's no financial benefit.
There's no financial benefit. The investor only gives the money to Kiva because they go to the Kiva website and they see a picture of a wonderful-looking person and they read their story and they say, I want to help that person. Now, in the fine print on Kiva's website, after some pushback, they have finally acknowledged that your money may not actually go to that person. But for the longest time, that was the myth, that you were funding that person, and then there was some studies done. Some people kind of investigated and found out that, you know what, the MFI, if you think about it, you just can't get the money. money from the investor, you know, your 50 bucks, and then when Mrs. Gonzalez's loan is fully funded, it goes from Kiva to the MFI, and then from the MFI out here. So what would happen is that when Mrs. Gonzalez comes to see the MFI, they would take her picture, write her story, give her her money, and then send it to the fund, and the fund would post it on the website. The investor would fund Mrs. Gonzalez, who actually already had your money, or somebody's money. And, you know, it's, but it drives it. The best book I have read in a long time about how donors' needs drive the charity industry is The Life You Can Save by Peter Singer. Peter Singer, the Princeton ethicist, this is his 30th book, famous for starting the animal rights movement. The Life You Can Save is fabulous on a couple of levels. Number one, it's the best thing there is on should we do domestic or international work as Americans. Secondly, he's got great social science research on what makes people give. There's some fabulous stories about how people will give more money to meet less needs of one starving children than, you know, it's a proven fact. A picture of one child will generate more of a donation than a picture of three children. Now, three children have more need than one children has. But donors are more interested in rescuing that one. And he's got great social science research on that.
Can the ultimate borrower, can he save money and put it back into the MFI?
In which fund? With Kiva?
Well, in general, the ultimate borrower, if he saves money, he can invest it in the MFI.
Well, MFIs, there are thousands of MFIs. And some of them provide savings instruments like the Green Bank, and some of them don't. We're almost out of time, and I really regret that I didn't watch the clock better. We've had a few questions. We should have had more. But I want to plug this book, which is in the bookstore. I don't think the Singer's book is in the bookstore, but you can look for it or order it. But Money and Faith is a hugely important document, especially for church groups. We used it at St. Mark's, and the group that studied it got so excited that they decided after they went through the whole book that they were going to split up and form three new groups and have three more study groups that did it. When was the last time you did a book study in your church where the group decided to scatter and study the same book with three times as many people in the next cycle of study? The table of contents have, the first section is the personal, money's place in our lives. The second section is the prophetic, money, sustainability, and the Jubilee. And the third one, the purposeful, how then shall we live? It's an anthology, which means that you get everybody from Dave Barry on the myth of money to Bill McKibben, Jean Bertrand Aristide,
Get Henry Nouwen in there.
Yeah, Henry Nouwen is in here. Thank you, Andy Loving. It's a wide variety. It's put together by Mike Scott, who was one of the early workers at Earth Ministry. It's a fabulous book, and it comes with a built-in study guide. So I highly recommend it. It's in the bookstore. You can read one chapter at a time. It's how many essays? I should study. I will before the next session and be able to tell you how many different chapters are in there.
Who was the editor?
Michael Scott, S-C-H-U-T. Thank you for that. And he writes many of the chapters. Includes a study guide for groups and individuals.
Yes.
Yeah. He's been to Holden.
He's been to Holden. That's right. We tried to get him to come this time, but he wasn't available. And I must be at about 59 minutes, so I should honor the...
Money and Faith.
It's in the bookstore. The Holden bookstore. I didn't check what the price is. You've been so patient, I just kept on going. I'm very sorry. But thank you for the patience.